Welcome back to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. The cells in our bodies have tiny power plants called mitochondria, and when they don't function normally, it's like a brownout or a blackout, causing muscle wasting, nerve damage, seizures, stroke, blindness, and more, depending on which cells are affected. Dr. Megan Landsverk is the director of the Molecular Genetics Division of the Sanford Clinical Medical Genetics Laboratory, and this afternoon at the Sanford Center, she's giving the talk, When Your Powerhouse Goes Bad, Mitochondrial Disease and Disorders, and she joins us on the line from Sioux Falls. And Dr. Landsverk, thanks for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Well, thanks for having me.
I have to admit that I was unfamiliar with mitochondrial disease. How common is it?
Well, I tell you what, Carl, that's exactly why I wanted to give a presentation like this, because mitochondrial disease occurs in one to every 4,000 to 5,000 individuals. So it's way more common than some of the other rare disorders. Collectively, mitochondrial disorders are way more common, but they're caused by so many different types of mutations that the spectrum is just really varied.
Now, in the introduction, I described mitochondria as the cell's power plants. That's kind of what I've been seeing in a lot of the websites talking about mitochondria. Is that adequate in explaining how they work, or is that just a nice shorthand to help us at least grasp a little bit of what's going on here?
Well, you know, it really is, and I'm going to have to admit I might just steal that for future presentations. I love the brownout analogy. It really is. But interestingly enough, when I talk about these things, even to, say, my husband, who's a teacher, the one thing that he always remembers from high school or from college is that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. But what that actually means is still a little bit unclear. And the interesting thing is we all are taught that mitochondria are involved in making energy for our cells, but only about 3% of the genes in the mitochondria are actually allocated to making ATP. So most of the genes in our nuclear genome and in our mitochondrial genome that are involved with mitochondrial disorders are actually involved in putting the mitochondria together, different enzyme syntheses, and all sorts of different reactions. So we have energy depletion, but mitochondria are also involved in all sorts of other cellular functions as well. So they can cause lots and lots and lots of different types of disorders.
Because they do so much.
Yes, exactly.
How easy is it to identify mitochondrial disease or disorders in a patient?
Well, it's actually really difficult for a lot of clinicians, again, because the clinical phenotype can be so varied. It depends on the type of mutation that one has, the type of tissue that one has. A lot of times, it will definitely be a muscle-type phenotype. So it could be anywhere from someone who has what we call hypotonia, or when we see it in babies, we call it floppy baby, where their muscles just can't hold them up anymore, to something as simple as droopy eyelids in an adult. But it affects your GI system, your liver, your kidneys, your brain, and it can be just about anything. So nailing down a mitochondrial disease for a clinician is actually a very difficult thing to do because there isn't, you know, a checklist of things that says, yep, this is a mitochondrial disorder.
Can you test for it?
Absolutely. And we have what we have in our cells is what we call our nuclear genome, right? So we have one copy of chromosomes from our mother, one copy of chromosomes from our father, but our mitochondria also have its own genome. And our nuclear genome and our mitochondrial genome work together to make all of the proteins in our mitochondria. And so based kind of on the clinical phenotype, a lot of times we'll direct the clinician as to where to start. Should they start looking at defects in the mitochondrial genome, or should they start looking at defects in the nuclear genome? The problem is, because the genes are so varied, there's a question of where to start. And that's the beauty of where genetics is going in this day and age, is that we have things called exomes and genomes, where we can actually now, instead of looking at one gene at a time, we can look at entire groups of genes or the entire genome at one time to help us pinpoint where those mutations are.
Is the research and the study in mitochondrial disease and disorders, is this something that is fairly recent as our understanding of genetics has evolved, or is this something that's been going on for a while?
Well, studies in general have been going on for a long time, and different researchers study different things as part of the mitochondria. In clinical diagnostics, what I do where we actually test patient samples clinically, there have only been a handful of labs around the country that do it. But more and more and more laboratories and clinical diagnostic laboratories are developing these tests every day. And so where if you had ordered a clinical test for mitochondrial disorder, you know, say even 5 years ago, there might have only been two or three laboratories in the country that would test for that. But because of where genetics is going and because the technology is becoming cheaper and we're getting more information based on research studies, more and more and more diagnostic labs are able to offer these testings.
Do researchers know what causes the mitochondria to malfunction?
They sort of do in some aspects. So mm-hmm. So there are some processes that the mitochondria does that we've got pretty nailed down. For example, there is a process that the mitochondria does to get rid of ammonia from our bodies. And if that process doesn't work, we get a buildup of ammonia. And all of those individual genes in that pathway have been identified, and we can kind of pinpoint them based on an individual's clinical diagnosis. But then there are other mitochondrial disorders where we know that there's a mutation in a gene that helps build the mitochondria, but how that mutation causes a clinical picture that we see in a patient is still really unknown. So the basic research behind mitochondrial testing is going to be unbelievably important in future studies and to help us kind of figure out what genes are causing the defects. Because there are over 1,000 genes that help build the mitochondria and help the mitochondrial function, but we only have probably less than 200 genes that have been linked to a clinical disease. So it's still really unknown what genes are causing all of the different mitochondrial disorders that we see.
Does this, because of the unknowns that you're talking about, Dr. Lenzer, does this make, for a researcher, this kind of exciting to be on the forefront of this?
Oh, absolutely. I have a number of colleagues. I've got a video that I show in the talk this evening from a colleague of mine that actually, he doesn't even study diseases. He studies what happens to the mitochondria when your cells die. And so when cells go through apoptosis, they release calcium and various other things, and there's all sorts of pathways, and all of that kind of rolls through the mitochondria. And so it's an organelle in your cell that's involved in just about everything that your cell needs to function. So it's the research behind this is definitely very exciting.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. We're talking with Dr. Megan Lenzwerk. She's the director of the Molecular Genetics Division of the Sanford Clinical Medical Genetics Laboratory. And this afternoon at the Sanford Center, she's giving the talk, When Your Powerhouse Goes Bad, Mitochondrial Disease and Disorders. Disease and disorders, is there a difference there?
Not really.
Yeah.
That was just kind of how we sort of threw the title together. So diseases and disorders are sort of essentially they go hand in hand. It just sounded better, I guess.
are there any treatments?
You know, for most mitochondrial diseases, no. So the ones that we know, and I'm going to talk about a couple of different cases of families that went through this. A lot of the more severe mitochondrial diseases are childhood onset. And what happens is, you know, families have these beautiful, healthy children that somewhere, oftentimes between the ages of 1 and 5, start developing things like seizures. They get very sick. They get very ill. And often what happens is these children die and they pass away before, you know, any treatment is tried. So there's really not a lot of preventative treatment for most mitochondrial disorders.
You mentioned childhood onset. Is this a disease that strikes anyone of any age, or are we talking mostly children?
Again, it depends. So most, based on the gene and the mutations, et cetera, and that's actually something else I'm going to discuss in my talk today, the variability of even within a single gene, that's involved in mitochondrial function. It kills children under the age of 5, or in adults, you know, it causes droopy eyelids. But most of the disorders hit children, but they can manifest later on in life as adults as well. But usually when it's an adult onset disorder, it's not something that's lethal. It doesn't, you know, eventually kill that individual. It makes their lives very difficult, but it doesn't end up, they don't pass away from it.
In doing some of the research on mitochondrial disease, trying to understand a little bit about it, it's somewhat related to Parkinson's and autism and other things?
Yep, there are some research. There is research out there about whether or not mitochondria are related. There are issues with the mitochondria that do cause some of those disorders. I will have to freely admit that I am not... I don't know as much about some of those disorders as to mitochondria affects it, but there are studies out there about how mitochondrial function, because if mitochondria are sick, right, then we don't produce the proper energy, and our cells can potentially die. And so that essentially kind of is the hypothesis, that your mitochondria aren't feeling so well, your cells can't function properly because you're not getting the energy that you need to, and then that causes some sort of clinical manifestation in a patient, depending on the tissue type that those sick mitochondria are in.
Could the manifestation be as simple as just not having any energy, something as simple as that, or is that...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. There are certain mitochondrial disorders, and it depends on the generation. So I have seen some families where, you know, initially a child presents to the doctor, and they can't walk quite right, they have low muscle tone, they're tired, they're exhausted, and they may have a whole spectrum of issues. And then you start talking to mom, and you say, okay, well, what about you? And mom says, well, you know, I feel pretty well, but I get headaches all the time. And those headaches may actually be because she has the same mitochondrial mutation as her child, but it manifests in a completely different way than the way it has manifested in her child. So sometimes it's things as simple as, you know, you get really, really tired when you exercise really hard, to headaches, to severe clinical presentations.
Now, this is a genetic disorder.
Yep.
And passed down from the mother's side?
Yes. And so, again, it depends on whether or not it's part of our mitochondrial genome or part of our nuclear genome. And that's, you know, again, one of the reasons that I wanted to give this talk is, you know, I can tell you that growing up, I had absolutely no idea what a mitochondrial genome was or that anything other than what we get from our mom and dad existed. And the mitochondrial genome is completely separate from our nuclear genome, and it exists just in our mitochondria. However, when the sperm meets the egg during fertilization, the mitochondria in the sperm are essentially destroyed. And so the only mitochondrial genome we inherit is from our mother. And so if your father has a mitochondrial disorder caused by a change in the mitochondrial genome, the children are totally okay. But it's only passed down through the mother. So a lot of times, it's very important to get a good family history, and that's one of the things our genetic counselors here at Sanford do, is when they talk to an individual and they say, okay, well, the child has it, and mom's got very similar phenotype, and grandma might have something like that too. We call that maternal inheritance, which means you just got it through moms, essentially. And when the counselors see something like that, that's kind of the first thing that often pops into one's head is like, okay, this went through the maternal line. It all came from moms. It might be a mitochondrial disorder.
How did you? You're talking about when you were growing up, you didn't know that, you know, about the mitochondria. Wondering how did you get involved into the study of molecular genetics?
Oh, so that's, yeah. I don't know if we have that much time for this. So I was born and raised in a small town near the Canadian border in North Dakota, and went to school at the University of North Dakota, and when I went to graduate school, I studied muscle development using a C. elegans nematode worm as an example, and muscle have a lot of mitochondria, so I learned a little bit about it then. But it was when I did my clinical molecular genetics training at the lab at Baylor College of Medicine. It's one of the labs in the country that does specialize in mitochondrial testing. And so I was exposed to all sorts of aspects of mitochondrial diagnostic testing that I was not familiar with, and learned that it really is a rare disease that is still somewhat common. And it's one of the reasons that I wanted to do this talk this evening is that, you know, I got all the way through graduate school and a postdoc until my clinical training before I learned about mitochondrial diseases, and I kind of want to share that with everyone here in a public setting.
A rare disease that's somewhat common.
I know. Collectively, yeah.
Now the talk that's for a general audience?
Yes. So what the talk is for is for the Sanford PROMISE program, and PROMISE stands for the Program for the Midwest Initiative in Science Exploration. It's an unbelievably fantastic program that they've started here at Sanford, and it's educating the public, educating high school students and people who want to come out and learn a little bit more about science and what's going on at Sanford and the different research projects. And I've been here at Sanford for about 7 months, and I've been at different institutions around the country, and I have to say that I've never seen an educational program put together as well as the Sanford PROMISE program, and it's really, you know, it's an honor of mine to be able to be a part of it and to, you know, give a talk like this to the public.